May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Stewart. I, along with Mr. Bowman, represent the appellants James Watson individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated. As the court knows, this arises out of challenges that the appellants are making to the red light camera enforcement laws in the state of Texas. These two cases were originally together. It was all brought as one piece. This is our second time to the Court of Appeals. We saw Judge Gabriel on an anti-SLAPP issue previously, and now we're back. Just procedurally how we got here. Mr. Watson got a ticket from the City of Southlake. All of these ordinances stem from and arise from the authority provided by the state by Chapter 707 of the Texas Transportation Code. Prior to that enactment, cities did not have any authority to assess civil penalties for the running of a red light. In 2007, the legislature passed Chapter 707 of the Transportation Code, purportedly to authorize cities to assess civil penalties. In that statute, the legislature mandates certain, and not just certain, the entire procedural method in which it is to be adjudicated, mandates the tribunals that are to adjudicate any issues, and mandates that the state get one half of all the profits that the cities generate from their red light camera programs. Now, Mr. Watson brought this against the City of Southlake, against Redflex, and the state, but also against all of the other cities and entities involved in red light camera enforcement as a class action. No issue in this case that Mr. Watson has standing against the City of Southlake to bring his actions. The court dismissed all of the defendants but Redflex on a standing issue, and I'll reach that subsequently. But first we'll deal with Southlake, because Mr. Watson's right to pursue the claims against all the other defendants from their standing to challenge Chapter 707 as a result of the Southlake enforcement. Now, Southlake was, so then the trial court dismissed them, severed out all those other defendants, then dismissed Southlake based on immunity. So first I'm going to deal with immunity. Southlake has no immunity with regard to the actions brought by Mr. Watson against Southlake. And the recent case out of this court of City of Bedford versus Tarrant County Apartment Association very well discusses and deals with almost all of the immunity and subject matter jurisdiction issues relative to the trial court in Southlake. Southlake claims that there's immunity from the declaratory judgment to declare the statute unconstitutional. And the action is not just to declare the ordinance unconstitutional, it's to declare Chapter 707 unconstitutional, or at least the significant portions of those two that relate to its actual adjudication and enforcement. And immunity is waived by the Declaratory Judgment Act with regard to actions like here, seeking declaratory judgment as to the validity of a statute or ordinance, as this court held in City of Bedford, and Bedford has long been held in various other cases, Texas Department of Transportation versus CEFSIC, which I think the court also cited in its opinion. So that basis was not a basis for the court to find immunity for Southlake. Another part of the immunity claim of Southlake is that the reimbursement claim that is being presented by Mr. Watson was barred by immunity because they want to characterize that as a claim for money damages. But as this court has described in City of Bedford, also in Brennan versus Willow Park, also out of this court, where the claim is for declaratory or injunctive relief seeking the refund of illegally collected monies. That claim is not barred if, as here, the plaintiff pleads that the payments were made as a result of fraud, mistake, or duress. And that has been specifically pled by the plaintiff here. The distinction with City of Bedford is they did not plead that in their case, and this court actually sent it back to the trial court to give them an opportunity to plead that. But the court recognized and ruled that where you're seeking the refund of illegally obtained monies, that is not subject to immunity if you actually plead the exception to the voluntary payment rule, which we've done in this case. So that doesn't serve as a foundation for the finding of immunity.
Are we barred from determining from the pleadings whether or not duress exists under the circumstances, or must we take your duress allegation as true on its face?
Well, I think we have alleged facts sufficient to raise the issue of duress. The trial court has not made a finding on the merits as to that, and I believe the trial court is entitled to make that finding before we are, rather than being barred from pursuing all of the evidence.
Well, part of the argument being made is that with regard to the exhaustion of remedies argument is in fact interrelated with your duress argument, which is you're not under duress because there was in fact a means by which you could have challenged the constitutionality of the statute through the administrative agency adjudication.
Okay, and so we're going to jump ahead. Exhaustion of remedies doesn't apply. And the reason exhaustion of remedies doesn't apply is you have no requirement to exhaust remedies that lack subject matter jurisdiction. And in this case, the remedies provided by Chapter 707 and adopted into every ordinance that's involved in this case are the city's assessed liability without any hearing. They then provide that you might have a hearing before an administrative hearing officer, with the only challenge from that going to the municipal judge. However, the matter involved in this case is a civil penalty of $75 with the potential for a $25 late payment charge. So $100 is the maximum amount in controversy in any city's one claim for a red light ticket violation. Article 5, Section 19 of the Texas Constitution places and mandates that exclusive jurisdiction of every civil matter less than $200 has to be adjudicated in the Justice of the Peace Court.
Did you raise that in the trial court prior to your motion for new trial?
No. And, so, as we've indicated in our brief, subject matter jurisdiction can never be waived.
But that's the subject matter jurisdiction of the court actually hearing your case. That's not the subject matter jurisdiction of some other court that might you might have to go to exhaust administrative remedies.
In fact, there's a case almost identical, Jupiter Chevrolet, that's in our brief, where the court held that the challenge to the jurisdiction of the administrative remedy in that case could be raised for the first time on appeal. This exact issue that we're talking about, we argued before the Texas Supreme Court Thursday of last week. So that is now pending before the court as to the effect of Article 5, Section 19 on these remedies. There is no basis for the legislature to take that civil matter and place it into a tribunal that lacks subject matter jurisdiction. In fact, Judge Gabriel, if a court or tribunal without subject matter jurisdiction proceeds through, no objection made, and enters a judgment, that judgment is void. It's not voidable. It's void, and it is subject to collateral attack as having been entered without subject matter jurisdiction without any statute of limitations whatsoever. It can be attacked at any time.
Actually, a judgment of a municipal court that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction would not be void. And any court has original inherent jurisdiction to determine its own subject matter jurisdiction. So what was preventing your client from going to the municipal court and challenging the subject matter jurisdiction of the municipal court under Article 5, Section 19, and obtaining a ruling at that point in time?
That's once again the waiver argument. The court, a tribunal without subject matter jurisdiction does have jurisdiction to determine it lacks jurisdiction. But if it truly lacks jurisdiction, that's the only authority it has, and it can only then at that point dismiss, saying we lack jurisdiction.
But that is something that could have been litigated in the municipal court by your client.
But it is not required to be litigated because the courts are clear that you do not have to engage in remedies that themselves lack subject matter jurisdiction. And the jurisdiction of the trial court, of the municipal court in this case, is only that jurisdiction that the administrative officer had, because it's an appeal by trial de novo. And in an appeal by trial de novo, the jurisdiction of the court to which the appeal is taken is limited to that jurisdiction of the tribunal from which that appeal is taken.
How can we find that you have, your client has suffered some form of duress when your client didn't give the city's municipal court the opportunity to address your subject matter jurisdiction argument? Because had that been made where it could have been made, and had the municipal court agreed with your interpretation of Chapter 707 in interrelationship to Article 5, Section 19, that court would have issued a judgment of dismissal, in which case your client would have paid no fine, because he wouldn't have had to have paid a fine until there was a final adjudication by the municipal court, and he would have not been injured in any way, shape, or form.
That would be true of any claim of reimbursement where the allegation it was paid for under duress. An illegal, as in Willow Park, Brennan versus Willow Park, the contractor paid the illegal fee under duress and sought to get it back. So what is not required,
but
and in this case,
do not those cases involve an absence of the ability to challenge the subject matter jurisdiction of the adjudicating court?
But duress does not go to subject matter jurisdiction in this regard, as far as the municipal court. The municipal court lacks any initial jurisdiction. Duress goes to whether or not immunity applies, not to the actual subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
I understand, but there's an interrelationship between those things. And the duress that you're arguing is that he had to pay the fine or all of these bad things would have occurred. And you are also arguing that there was no remedy available in the administrative process. And I've just demonstrated to you there was, in fact, a remedy available that he did not attempt. So even though that has the same effect as making an argument for exhaustive remedies, it also undercuts the argument for duress that he was, in fact, forced to do what he says he was forced to be injured by. They're interrelated in that regard.
Well, I disagree with that. The issue, the initial issue is there any jurisdiction in those remedies? And there's not. And once that is determined, what is required is that the state should have provided and the municipality should be doing is initiating that claim against the accused in the Justice of the Peace Court, because the Justice of the Peace Court has the exclusive original jurisdiction of this civil penalty matter.
Okay, now let's go to your interpretation of Article 5, and let's jump to that right now, okay?
Okay.
Your interpretation of the $200 or less civil action would apply to literally any penalty parking, any other moving violation that is permitted for municipalities to enforce under Texas law or under their own ordinances. And that would apply for the 20 years before Chapter 707 was in fact enacted. So you're asking us to find that your interpretation of Article 5, Section 19 literally invalidates any penalty that can be characterized as a civil penalty, whether it be for parking, whether it be for moving violations, anything of that nature, and that literally anybody who has obtained or been forced to pay a parking fine in any municipality since 1985, if that was not adjudicated by a justice court, they're entitled to reimbursement of that fine. That's what you're arguing, because that's your interpretation of Article 5, Section 19.
Respectfully, with regard to parking tickets specifically, those are misdemeanors. Those are criminal actions. So that is a different matter. It's not a civil matter. It's a criminal matter.
Not in the city of Fort Worth.
Well, in that case, I would agree with you, Your Honor. If it's a civil matter, the fact that it's inconvenient for the city is not an excuse to ignore the Constitution. The Constitution mandates that jurisdiction in the Justice of the Peace Court. The legislature and the cities don't have any authority to circumvent the Constitution in that regard.
They depend on what the term civil action meant in Article 5, Section 19.
When Article 5 doesn't use the term civil action, it uses the term civil matter.
Civil matter. I stand
which is
corrected.
That's broader than if they had used the term civil action. Civil matter is anything that's civil. And in this case, there's no dispute that a civil penalty is a civil matter.
You mentioned the Supreme Court case that was argued last week.
Yes.
And I had plenty of briefs to read for this case. So pardon me, I did not read the briefs for the case that was argued in the Supreme Court last week.
Golly, I'm glad you admitted that.
But let me ask you this, and I didn't listen to it being argued either.
It just got posted today anyway.
Okay. Are the issues similar enough in that case that whatever they do at the Texas Supreme Court is going to be instructive and dispositive to us in this case, or are there different issues out there?
No,
it's the same issue.
It's dispositive of this issue in this case. And getting back to the discussion we just had, insofar as the Constitution gives to any court, this is a direct quote, to any of the courts in exclusive jurisdiction over any subject matter, it is not within the power of the legislature to give that jurisdiction to another tribunal in the absence of an express grant of such power to the legislature by the Constitution. That is State versus Gillette's estate from 1946 from the Texas Court of Commission of Appeals. And it's citing another Supreme Court case, Timmons versus Bonner. Now, the Constitution does deal with granting administrative tribunals adjudicative authority, and that comes under Article 5, Section 8, district court jurisdiction. And that has an express provision allowing the legislature to take jurisdiction from the district court and put it in an administrative agency. That express authorization is not found in Article 5, Section 19. Therefore, there are no exceptions that all civil matters involving $200 or less have to be originally adjudicated in the Justice of the Peace Court. And there's a 1989 Texas Supreme Court, State versus Thomas, where the court held that the legislature cannot obliterate a constitutional grant of power merely by statutorily creating an agency to serve the same function as courts. And that's what we have here. This thing should have been set up and it should be adjudicated in the Justice of the Peace Court. And what the legislature tried to do was do an end run and obliterate that power of the Justice of the Peace Court, and that it cannot do.
So essentially, you're arguing that in ratifying Article 5, Section 19, the people of the state of Texas intended to withdraw from the municipalities any authority through their municipal courts to adjudicate any moving violation, anything of that nature, of a civil matter nature that was $200 or less in terms of the actual fine or penalty involved. And that was what was intended when it was ratified in 1985.
When it was voted in. That's the clear language of Article 5, Section 19. So the district court has jurisdiction over the claims presented against Southlake. There is no immunity. There's no exhaustion of remedies requirement. There's also, in addition to that, even if you assumed that the hearing officer had jurisdiction over did the car run a red light and who was the owner, those issues are not even involved in the claims in this case. These claims are constitutional challenges to the ordinance and the statute itself. And administrative hearing officers lack any jurisdiction, unless granted by statute, to rule on constitutional issues. So there never was any jurisdiction in the administrative hearing officer with regard to the issues being raised and adjudicated in this case.
And that's why and that's the reason why the affirmative defense of which was available under this ordinance to say that I wasn't the driver and I wasn't in the state and it wasn't me, that would be an adjudication by a hearing officer and then a municipal court without jurisdiction, and therefore the affirmative defense really doesn't matter.
The problem with that is Chapter 707 doesn't provide that as an affirmative defense. Chapter 707 sets forth specific affirmative defenses that it allows, and that's not one of them. In fact, it sets up an irrebuttable presumption that the owner is the driver unless he's in the business of buying or leasing cars or the car gets stolen.
Actually, the statute actually specifically says that it has to interact with the criminal transportation code provision, and that there can't be any conflict. So in this particular instance, if you can prove that the individual was violating the law who was driving your vehicle, then that would be a criminal matter that's authorized by the statute. And that's my reading of the ordinance, but maybe I'm reading that incorrectly.
Because there's also a provision in the Texas Transportation Code that says an owner cannot be held liable for a violation unless he authorizes it, or I forget what the exact language, but he's got to say, you've got to prove he knew about it and he authorized it and approved it. And this irrebuttable presumption violates that as well, because it places liability irrespective of whether the owner knew about it, was there, which is why that irrebuttable presumption itself is a violation of due process, because under the statute, he cannot rebut that presumption.
Thank you.
I've been tasked with addressing an issue for the first 5 minutes that Watson didn't address, which is the standing under the juridical link doctrine, which impacts almost 50 parties in this case, every city except Southlake and Xerox and ATS. Watson asserts that this doctrine gives him standing to bring claims against these defendants from whom he did not sustain an injury, but for two reasons he's wrong. Number one, Heckman, the Texas Supreme Court, says he cannot borrow standing from other people, unnamed class representatives. The holding is very clear on that. And number two, the doctrine does not apply to standing. It only applies to class certification requirements. So I think this court could resolve this part of the opinion two ways. One, it could strictly look at Heckman, and it could follow it to the letter of the opinion, and this case is over with as to those 50-some-odd defendants that I'm speaking about. And why do I say this? because Heckman has several holdings that drive that decision. One, standing analysis is the same whether this is a class action or a non-class case. So he doesn't get a lighter standard. He doesn't get to go borrow from unnamed class representatives the injury that he wants. That's number one. Number two, they come right out and say it. They say he cannot borrow standing from someone else because he still must show a concrete injury attributable to one of these defendants, and he cannot do that. He admits he can't do that. He admits he wants to twist the juridical link doctrine to get there, and I'll talk about that in a minute.
In other words, he has to suffer an injury that's representative of the class.
He has to do much more than that, Your Honor, I think. That's not enough. Heckman says there has to be a plaintiff with an injury that's traceable under the claim to that defendant, and this plaintiff cannot do that. He's admitted he was not injured by any of the plaintiffs or any of the defendants that I'm speaking about. So it can't be on a class-wide basis. Heckman says it's a plaintiff-by-plaintiff, claim-by-claim basis.
No, even though the claim being made here is that the statute did something that was unconstitutional, okay, which would, of its very nature, end up invalidating every ordinance that was created under the statute as to all of those municipalities. But there's an injury component that has to be related specifically to each of the defendants.
Correct, for the standing analysis. Correct.
So you're arguing essentially that he's arguing some type of vicarious liability through the enactment of the statute, which is not recognized.
I don't believe that's exactly what he's argued. In our brief, we tried to identify his precise argument, and it was distilled down to one of two things under the juridical link doctrine. You can either say something similar to what Your Honor has just said, which is a concerted action or a conspiracy. That's not what he alleged. He alleged that it would be most expeditious, and to save judicial economy, we ought to confer standing on everybody, even though he can't prove an injury. That defies Heckman and the law on standing in this state.
Would it also defy the fact the Supreme Court's already got this issue about the validity of the statute in front of it?
Well, and it has it with someone
so
who
in
was
terms
actually,
of judicial economy?
Correct. I would agree with you wholeheartedly.
Okay.
Very briefly, if this court even entertained the juridical link doctrine, it certainly doesn't apply to standing. The doctrine was from dicta in a 1973 Ninth Circuit case where they left the door open as to adequacy and typicality. That court assumed without deciding standing. We now know that that was wrong. You always take the threshold issue of standing first. In his briefing, he said a few things that are incorrect. One, he has said that four courts of appeals have adopted the juridical link doctrine as to standing. Absolutely incorrect. I urge you to look at all four of those cases. None of them deal with the juridical link doctrine in the context of standing. A few of them deal with it in the context of class certification requirements. The U.S. Supreme Court has never adopted this doctrine in any context. The Texas Supreme Court has never adopted this doctrine in any context. And as far as we can tell, the Fifth Circuit has chosen not to when it's been expressly presented to it. If the panel doesn't have any questions, I'll yield the rest of my time to one of my colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. When somebody comes to court to stop the enforcement of a law, the proper defendant is naturally going to be the entity that actually enforces that law. And when somebody comes to court asking for reimbursement of an allegedly unlawfully paid fine, the proper defendant is going to be the entity that enforced and collected the payment. There's no question that the state does not enforce the law and does not collect the payment. And so the state is not a proper defendant in this case. And those are two reasons that this court could affirm, at least as to the state, that don't have anything to do with what was argued.
Even though the statute specifically creates an agency relationship with the city or the municipality with regard to the distribution of a portion of the penalty to the state?
Well, I disagree that there is an agency relationship. What Heckman, I believe it was, mentioned was that when you have a third party that's acting, has independent actions, it breaks the standing causation. And that's what's true here. No city.
So even though the statute itself requires the municipality if they adopt through an ordinance this specific type of process under Chapter 707, and it specifically requires that the penalties that are permitted under Chapter 707, that there is a portion therewith that shall be remitted to the state for state purposes, that the mere fact that the municipality does the collecting, the remitting has absolutely no, does not create an agency relationship?
Correct, and that's because, as you mentioned in your question, the cities do not have to have this program. There's no requirement that they collect anything. They don't have to have these programs. They don't have to enforce red light penalties. And the difference really here crystallizes into the fact that you have, the state is a, can be a beneficiary downstream, but the question isn't who's a beneficiary when it comes to standing. The question is who caused the injury. The injury is having to pay the money. Who gets that money down the line is a separate question that doesn't go to the cause of the injury. If the state was, if the money was never given to the state, that wouldn't change one iota the injury to the plaintiff. Where that money goes doesn't matter to him. And that's what causation is about. And that's one reason as far as the money goes, as far as the reimbursement. That's why the state can't be on the hook for that. But it's also important as to the declaratory judgment and the injunctive relief claims, because the state can't be responsible for a declaratory injunctive relief claim when it's not the one who enforces law. It doesn't provide the tickets. And there's a good case on this, which is Lone Star Multi-Theaters, and that's 922 Southwest 2nd at 295. That's a third court case. That's quite analogous to here, because individuals sought declaratory and injunctive relief against the state, wanting to prevent the enforcement of an obscenity law that was a state law. And the court said, no, there's no justiciable controversy here because the state doesn't enforce anything. So any declaratory judgment or injunction can't stop the enforcement, which is what you want. And just to flag two quick things before moving off of that, because I think that it's important, is that these issues about the state not enforcing the law are separate from the issues that were briefed and argued at the Supreme Court last Thursday. So the court could also affirm on the fact that there's no standing for prospective relief when they've already paid their fine, that there's no duress, as you pointed out, Judge Birdwell, where you have somebody who has not taken advantage of the process, because duress is really a factual question. Did you have any way out? And they could have invoked administrative proceeding. They would have immediately stayed all their penalties while they litigated either in one form or another. But the court doesn't have to answer those as to the state here, because it can affirm simply on the basis that it doesn't enforce the law, so it can't have injunctive relief against the state, and you can't get reimbursement against the state. There are no further questions. We ask that the court affirm.
May it please the court. I'm George Staples. I'm representing a whole bunch of cities. There's two appeals involved here, and because all the items or the matters that were addressed in the appeal of the Southlake case are also addressed in the appeal of the other case, we've only provided copies of our appellee's brief in the second case for the panel's review. Maybe that'll cut down on your paperwork a little bit. When we refer to appellee's brief in this argument, we're referring to the brief provided to the panel. Except where otherwise stated, references to the appellant's reply brief are intended to refer to appellant's reply brief to our brief herein. As has been noted, this is a case against 50 cities, the state of Texas, and three camera providers. This case is not the same as the Willis case, which was argued before the Supreme Court on Thursday, which I did watch while it was going on. It's unique among all other red light camera cases decided to date, because there's no allegations that any of the cities in this case violated the statutes concerning committees, conferences, or recommendations. Plaintiffs' attempt to obtain a refund of civil penalties paid and attorney's fees for doing so are based in this case entirely on alleged constitutional defects with the statutes. As has been noted, Southlake has a provision where if he just files an affidavit said, I wasn't driving it, here's who was, he gets out. It provides that. Now, Mr. Stewart says, well, you can't provide anything additional to statute. That's not true. Southlake is a home rule city. That's all agreed. case law on the subject supports the right of the city to create such a defense. How in the world can you complain because the city decides to give you an extra defense? Now, because counsel for the state and other defendants and Judge Birdwell have already addressed the standing and the duress issues, I'm going to try not to repeat those arguments because I ain't got enough time. And also, I think we need to address the issues of their failure to plead any ground of unconstitutionality, as well as the failure to exhaust administrative remedies. Now, appellant contends that the challenge to the failure to allege a constitutional violation involves the merits, and that that's improper in a plea to the jurisdiction is simply incorrect. We address this contention on pages 21 through 23 of our brief. We're not claiming the appellant has failed to plead constitutional provisions or that he's required to prove anything, but that the facts alleged are simply not constitutional violations. Much of the appellant's reply brief is an attack on the recent case involving the city of Richardson versus Bowman, which we have both cited, in which the Dallas Court of Appeals rejected all of the constitutional contentions of the appellant here. The Richardson case is well written and clearly shows how appellant's constitutional arguments are specious. This is, as stated in our brief, an administrative law case in which the legislature created a pervasive regulatory scheme establishing both penalties and procedures for red light camera violations, civil penalty cases. Chapter 707 of the Texas Transportation Code provides for initial determination of liability by an administrative agency hearing officer with revision appeal exclusively to the municipal court of a city adopting the regulation. We don't have any arguments about what the statute provides. But what we say here is that the appellant is attempting to justify his failure to exercise administrative remedy, attempted to use a declaratory judgment, injunction, and suit for reimbursement to get his money back on the premise that the statute ordinances are unconstitutional. Even if such a remedy were available, the appellant has simply failed to allege any facts which might make any part of the statute unconstitutional. Appellant has attempted to raise, without pleadings, a challenge based on the unpled theory that Article 5, Section 19 of the Constitution gives justices of the peace exclusive jurisdiction over civil matters $200 or less. We address this on pages 25 through 27 of our brief. This is a waiver when you fail to plead it. They say, oh, yeah, but we put it in our motion for new trial. You don't get to amend your pleadings after judgment. We had a judgment dismissing the city of South Lake and dismissing all these other folks, and there was never any other pleading.
Didn't they file a motion for leave to file a seventh amended pleading?
After the judgment, yes,
I understand that. Was that ever ruled on by the court?
It was denied.
Okay. Thank you.
As I said, I would agree the proceedings in this case are somewhat confusing. This case has been going on forever. It's been to the Fifth Circuit and back. But Mr. Stewart and Mr. Bowman and I, we've been on board the whole time. There's nothing we have not argued or at least taken a look at. Now, appellant challenges the pleadings issue, claiming he raises his motion for new trial and motion to amend, which was filed after the judgment, and that this is somehow jurisdictional and it can be considered even though there's no pleading. You've already addressed this, so I'm not going to beat that one up, but it's not jurisdictional as far as the district court, so that doesn't make it jurisdictional where it can be considered by the Court of Appeals. Pleadings can't be amended after judgment. Even if it had been pled, Article 5, Section 19 is not authority for any limitation on an administrative agency. The only two courts which have considered this issue in the agency context rejected that proposition. Those two cases are Howell, which we cite on pages 27 through 29 of our brief, and the City of Richardson case, which just came down from the Dallas Court of Appeals. As shown on pages 29 through 35 of our appellee's brief, an administrative agency is not a court, and granting exclusive jurisdiction to an administrative agency is well within the authority of the legislature. Article 5, Section 1, as well as Article 5, Section 8 of the Constitution, clearly gives authority to the legislature to change the jurisdiction of all courts. It's also worth noting that the civil penalties imposed under the statute are not judgments. Enforcement of these penalties would have to be by a lawsuit that the city would have to file. And if it was under $200, it'd have to file it in JP court. We agree the Constitution would apply to that. But that has nothing to do with the agency decision. Now, as I said, if you need to see what we've said about it, what the ordinance of the city of Southlake provides, that is contained on court record 482. It's also in appellant's brief in the Southlake case in appendix tab 3, page 1067. It clearly provides that Southlake, if they want to collect that sucker, they got to go to court and sue. Now, appellant in his reply brief cites City of Bedford, and you just heard him argue about what he said, for the proposition that this court has ruled contrary to the argument on pages 45 through 48 of the appellee's brief, to the extent that if monetary relief is sought, declaratory judgments are barred by immunity. That contention is untrue. The City of Bedford case did not involve a suit for damages. In that case, y'all decided, you know what it says, an apartment association challenged the city's ordinances establishing licensing fees as being arbitrary and unreasonable and sought a declaratory judgment that fees were unconstitutional and that the apartment owners, not the apartment, not the association bringing the lawsuit, were entitled to a refund. The court correctly held that the association didn't seek any damages and that the fact that the owners were entitled to a refund is not a suit where monetary relief is involved. Appellant also cites Bland versus Blue and also City of Bedford, the proposition that all is required for a declaratory judgment claim is an allegation that specific provisions of the Constitution were violated by certain fees. That's not what the court held. Now, as I said, I've got to limit my remarks here because I let these other folks argue this stuff, but I need to at least talk about this, the business about the failure to exhaust administrative remedies. There is no subject matter jurisdiction of any court to hear a challenge to a red light civil penalty case by a party who fails to exhaust administrative remedies. This was the holding of the Edwards case in 2011, the City of Willis case in 2017, and the City of Richardson case in 2018. Appellant relies on City of Sherman and Westheimer versus Roquette for the position that there is an exception to the requirement for exhaustion when process provided is unconstitutional. That reliance is misplaced. They made no such holding. A reading shows that what these was involved was an attempt to exercise authority beyond statutory authority. In that situation, the court held that, yes, the courts could get involved in that. Now, the Texas Supreme Court has ruled consistently that exhaustion of administrative remedies is required before attempting to challenge the constitutionality of statutes requiring establishing exclusive jurisdiction. We have cited the court to these decisions on pages 64 through 66 of our brief. Stewart is particularly significant because this is a case in which administrative law case where the court held that you've got to exercise the stuff in the statute even if you're saying that what the agency did was unconstitutional.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Sure.
Going back to my original discussion with regard to the ability of the municipal court to make its own determination of whether or not it had jurisdiction, if it made a determination that it did have jurisdiction, what remedy is available to either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, or would that be a conclusive determination of jurisdiction by the municipal court that would not be subject to review?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that position. Now, the fact of the matter is,
does that not create a due process issue? Does that not create a due process issue that a court makes its own decision about whether or not it has jurisdiction that is not subject to review by either a court of appeals or the Supreme Court?
If you'll recall, Your Honor, there is no right, constitutional right of appeal. That doesn't exist. The appeal process is set out by what it is. These are generally established by the legislature. And remember, all we're talking about in this situation is a determination that has to be enforced by a lawsuit. Presumably, if that were done in the Justice of the Peace Court, then whatever process would be available would be available there. All this does is just establish an administrative decision, and it establishes a measure of there's no reason in the world why a municipal court cannot decide constitutionality. Not every case is appealable. There are limits as far as amounts are concerned, and there's never been any issue as far as for that part is concerned. We would take the position that there, and again, it is a hypothetical situation, because none of those were even attempted. In a situation where you don't have anybody who exercised the remedies, the court has said it's a matter of judicial economy. The Supreme Court has said repeatedly, City of Dallas versus VSC, if a remedial procedure might have obviated the needs for taking suit, then the property simply had not, prior to the procedure's use, been taken without just compensation. He's got to exhaust those remedies, or he's foreclosed from bringing a lawsuit in order to seek refunds.
I've got a question. You take issue with the other side's comment that the Supreme Court case that was argued last week would resolve all the issues. After the Supreme Court decides the case that it heard last week, what's left for us to decide then in your mind?
My hope is it will decide it. It's all likelihood it will decide the specific issue as far as the constitutionality is concerned. But there's at least a possibility that they may say, you know, there's other issues involved in here, such as one of the issues in that one is whether or not the individuals who were sued in that suit, the officers who were sued in their individual. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not really their individual capacity. They're sued in their official capacity.
The ultra vires.
It's the ultra vires argument, and this case does not have any ultra vires issues. So, theoretically, I think it will decide it. The truth will be known.
But it is slightly different, and it could come out where it's not instructive to us.
Possibly, but as I said, I think the authority is out there, and it's pretty clear. I don't think there's any much argument among anybody that's looked at this stuff that the position Mr. Stewart and Mr. Bowman are urging is simply it's not accurate. And as I said, I don't think that I'm not sure the Willis case had the pleadings issue as far as whether or not the Article 5, Section 19 was even properly pled. It may have been in that case. There's so many of these cases, and I'm not participating in all of them, even though I filed an amicus brief in the for the Supreme Court last week. So there are some other issues there.
Okay, so essentially we've got four cases. We've got Bowman, which is out of Dallas.
Yep.
We've got Garza, which is out of one of the Houston courts.
The City of Willis case, I think.
City of Willis versus Garza.
Yes.
And we've got Edwards.
Edwards.
Which I think was Tyler.
Yes.
No, Dybul. Hunt was Tyler.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there's others.
And I think one of them was Bowman Mott. One of the three that found there wasn't a problem with the statute.
Right.
And one was Beaumont, one was Houston, and
yes.
One was Dallas.
And
then Hunt found there was a problem.
The problem in that case was
but,
they failed
but
to
hang on,
the
hang
ordinance.
Hang on. The distinction I read that you guys are making is that with regard to the Hunt case, because the ordinance itself was invalid because it didn't follow the ordinance requirements of publication.
Yes.
So the underlying authority, then it was found by the Tyler Court that the entire process that was authorized by 701 was not actually initiated, and therefore that could be addressed by the district court in that particular case. Whereas in the other three cases, There are arguments about whether or not the process that is set forth in Chapter 707 was properly followed by the cities.
Yes.
With regard to their ordinances.
Right, and there's an argument on all those cases, including the Richardson case, having to do with whether or not these procedures, as far as establishing a committee and doing all those fun things and doing studies and that sort of thing, and the fact that the statute exempts cities that passed the ordinances, you know, before a certain date, had to follow those. So those issues are actually involved. None of that's involved in this case here.
Thank you. Will you give him an additional 5 minutes? If you need an additional 5 minutes, you have it.
It's been a long week already, Your Honor. It's only Tuesday, but I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
First off, just in response to your questions to counsel about the effect of the Supreme Court case, it will decide the Article 5, Section 19 issue that's been raised in this case, just so the court will know. Part of that issue was brought up for the first time to the appeals court, which makes that part a little different than here. Like in response to your questions, Justice Gabriel, what happened here was set forth in our brief. The trial court initially, in its letter to the parties, stated that it was denying Redflix's anti-SLAPP motion, it was denying Southlake's plea to jurisdiction, but it was granting all of the other defendants' pleas to jurisdiction based on lack of standing. What happened after that was Redflix appealed the denial of their anti-SLAPP motion, which stayed everything until that appeal was done. After that was done, the court, next thing we know, we get an order that granted Southlake's plea based on immunity, and that was not after any hearing or anything. It just came out from the court on its own. So at that point, we did exactly all we could do, and that was file a motion for new trial where we brought up the Article 5, Section 19 ground. The judge denied that motion, so that we've done all we need to do to preserve that, which is we presented it timely to the trial court. The trial court ruled on it, denied it, so that the issue of whether Article 5, Section 19 deprives the remedies of the red light camera laws of jurisdiction has been properly preserved. It's not waived, even if it could be
waived. But there was a hearing on Southlake's original plea to the jurisdiction that was then denied as part of the anti-SLAPP ruling and the dismissal on standing of all the other cities, correct?
Correct.
And all that happened is that the district court, she changed her mind once the anti-SLAPP issue had been resolved by this court. She issued a different ruling in that regard.
Correct.
Which she had jurisdiction to do.
Correct, Your Honor. Not disputing that, but what's important is under the Kosoglu case that we've cited, you know, that holds a party can stand on its pleadings till a plea to jurisdiction has been granted. So we had the letter from the court saying their plea was denied. We were doing exactly what Kosoglu says we were entitled to, and that is to stand on our pleadings. Once the judge did do something different, we acted timely, presented it in the form of a motion for new trial, which is all you could do. And the other thing we did do, and you had asked this, Justice Gabriel, about whether we had filed a motion for leave to file an amended petition after the judge had done that, and we did do that. That's found in volume 3 of the record, pages 1351 to 1453 of volume 3 of the record. And the judge granted the motion to amend the petition, but what she did is she didn't sign the order so that we could then file that until after she had signed the order granting Southlake's plea. And that's reflected in pages 1572 and 1575 of volume 3 of the record. So it's kind of like, okay, we got it granted, but it's not going to do any good since you've granted the plea. So again, we did all we could do to preserve that issue.
Was this Article 5, Section 19 issue raised in the Willis case in the same manner that it was raised here?
No, actually, in the Willis case, it didn't come up first until we presented it in a motion for rehearing after the Court of Appeals had issued its opinion.
So the Supreme Court will be dealing with the waiver issue as well?
Correct. That's one of the issues that was briefed, Your Honor. And another issue that was briefed, since the Court of Appeals had mentioned it in its opinion, kind of, I mean, you'll be able to see it reading their opinion, but they also commented on immunity, so that was another issue that was briefed by the parties. So the court should address that. The only issue that's involved here that's not involved in the Willis case is the juridical link standing issue. And on that, Your Honor, you hit what I believe is the key, and that is, as long as Watson's injury is representative of those in the class, and if all the other defendants are acting uniformly under a statute that's alleged to be unconstitutional, like what you have here, juridical link doctrine applies. You know, good examples are the Cedar Crest.
But why, again, this goes back to my issue, why would we find the judicial economy, okay, when in fact the issue that you are addressing, i.e., that Chapter 707 is facially unconstitutional because it permits municipalities to adjudicate
through municipal courts as opposed to justice courts, okay, which would mean that there's a commonality with regard to all municipalities. But that issue's in front of the Supreme Court, so there's not really a judicial economy issue here with regard to that, because the Supreme Court's going to make that decision.
Not as far as juridical link, you're not, Your Honor.
Now, they might not, because they might make a determination that raising it by motion for rehearing at the Court of Appeals waived it, but I want to confirm, you guys actually made the argument you're making to us, which is the subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, of the municipal court can be raised at any time, and that argument has been specifically made to the Supreme Court.
Correct, Your Honor. And that argument being, okay, it goes to the remedies having a lack of jurisdiction, so that therefore exhaustion is not required, so the case can proceed in district court. And on that point, you had mentioned something in questioning counsel about, you know, if the about whether there would be any appeal if the municipal court, you know, had ruled on this. And the answer to your question is not, because as part of this, the legislature passed section 29.003G of the government code, which gives exclusive appellate jurisdiction in a case arising under chapter 707 solely to the municipal court. And the problem there, Your Honor, is the hearing officer doesn't have any authority to decide whether a statute's constitutional. That's City of Dallas versus Stewart, and I think there's another case that we've cited in our brief. Since he doesn't have any authority, the municipal court judge doesn't either in his appeal by trial de novo status, because as we pointed out in our brief, Childress Oil and some of the other cases, the court in an appeal by trial de novo only has the jurisdiction that the hearing officer has. So if the hearing officer can't decide issues of constitutionality, the municipal court judge couldn't. So if you follow what the legislature did with 29003G, they've created a statute that could never be subject to constitutional review. And you ask whether that would violate due process. It probably would, and another thing it would definitely violate is the separation of powers clause, because it's the power of the judiciary to determine whether a law passed by the legislature is constitutional or not, and what they've done here is completely sidestepped that process and made a statute that can't be subject to constitutional review. And then one other point I want to bring up, Justice Birdwell, when you're asking Mr. Stewart about, well, Mr. Watson could exhaust these remedies, the answer to that is no, because the way the statute is set up, when the vehicle owner gets this ticket, he's already found liable. If he wants to contest it, he can do so, but he's got 30 days to either pay it or contest it. And the statute also provides in section 707.012 that the failure to timely pay it constitutes an admission of liability. So when you've got a vehicle owner like Watson, and then in addition, the Southlake ordinance that's...
But you stay the payment requirement if you contest it.
So you have the hearing, and then after that, once you're found liable, since Mr. Staples brought up how their ordinance allows you to show someone else was driving, as part of our pleadings and the evidence showed, the notice Redflix sends out doesn't state that in its notice. Matter of fact, it completely fails to address that and says that only if you're a leasing company or you're in the business of buying, selling cars, or your car's been stolen or you've sold it, can you sign this affidavit identifying someone else as the driver. And that's part of our claims against Redflix, including for fraud, that judge hasn't dismissed those. That's part of what we pled is the basis for reimbursement. And in response to your question, those allegations would control under Texas Department v. Miranda that we've cited.
Can I ask one more question? Just concerning what the Supreme Court has and what they don't. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Davis indicated that the some of the state issues that are existent in this case were not existent in the cases in the Willis case. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, because okay. the state is not a party to that action, at okay. least at the moment.
That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we thank you for your argument. It was very helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted, and you're free to leave and go about your business.